See everyone this morning. I hope everyone's doing well. This morning we're going to be studying Genesis chapter 15 and hopefully get into Genesis chapter 16 is the goal. Evan was supposed to teach this morning, but Evan's sick this morning. He's dealing with some really bad ear pain. He's at an urgent care this morning. He tried to call me at 6:30 this morning. My phone sits by my nightstand, and when I'm up and getting the kids ready, I don't look at my phone until I leave. And so I found out at 8:25 that I needed to teach this morning. So Dale was said I could do it, you know, and but I said, no, I would like to do it. It's a good challenge for me, I think, to jump in here and do the best I can. So thankfully, Dale did get his PowerPoint. I've scanned through it in about 1 minute, and I looked at a few things. So just so you know, I'm going to need your help this morning. And I did read through this before I went to bed. I read through the text and I thought of some things. And so I think we'll be able to take some good things away from the text in our study. And it ties wonderfully together to what we studied on Wednesday. But obviously, it's not going to be as thorough as I would like. And I don't have a prepared PowerPoint that I've made. And I'm sorry for that. And I apologize for that. But things happen. Life happens sometimes. And he does have a wonderful slide we're going to be looking at here in a minute that shows a wonderful map that really does show a fulfilled promise to Abram. And so we are going to be looking at that. But if you remember on Wednesday night, we were in chapter 13, chapter 14. In Genesis chapter 14, what we were reading about was this war of nine kings. There were four kings versus five. The four kings defeated the five. Who were two of the kings, two of the cities involved in the five kings? Sodom and Gomorrah, right. So they're defeated. As they try to run away and escape, they fall into tar pits. I talked about that's a really interesting thing to look up. Some digs that they've done where sea level has changed and such, and some tar pits are exposed in that area kind of south of the Dead Sea. And when that occurs, and they escape, or they're taken and defeated, the winning kings, the four kings, they take Lot. They take Lot, they take his belongings. And so at this point, what happens is a fugitive comes to Abram and tells him of what has occurred. Where is Abram at this time? That's right. So he's in this new land that was separated from Lot. That's right. It's Hebron. It says, if you want to look specifically in verse 18, it describes this Oaks of Mamre as also being Hebron in verse 18 of chapter 13. But also it says it down here in chapter 14 also. But we talked about this great trek that he would have made to try to save Lot. People say it could have been 150 miles, 240 miles, but him traveling from Hebron all the way up to Dan to try to save his nephew just says so much. And he had these 318 men with him. Even after they defeat this army, he continues to pursue them all the way toward Damascus. And so this was not some easy undertaking where it's like, hey, we're just ready for war, let's go. He's some commanding officer. I mean, he is overtaking four kings who just defeated five kings. He is defeating the victor. And so it shows great faith on the part of Abram to say, let's go and let's go take care of business. I'm going to go save my nephew. Is he successful? Yes. And Kenny was talking about this in the other class. He overtakes them in the night. And so that's the way that they attack. And that's the way that they are able to recover all of the goods here. They're very smart about how he divides the forces against them by night. In verse 15, he and his servants, he defeats them. And so he brings back all the goods. After this, how do the defeated kings feel about this? When they get the news that the four kings have been defeated. How do you think the king of Sodom feels? Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Let's do something to thank Abram. He just defeated the ones that beat us. So, what can we do for him? And so, specifically here at the end of chapter 14, there is, after the defeat of Chedorlaomer, the kings who were with him, this is in verse 17, the king of Sodom went out to meet them at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley, and who is introduced here? Melchizedek. And we talked a little bit about Melchizedek. We could have had a whole class on Melchizedek or more. Because Melchizedek ties so well to Psalm chapter 110, talking about how according to the order of Melchizedek, Christ would be a priest. But it is so interesting because this almost catches us out of left field. Have we heard of priests before, prior to this, in the book of Genesis? No. And you're thinking, he's a priest of the Most High God? Where did this come from? Well, that's what we talked about, is that Jesus Christ also was not of the tribe of Levi. He was of the tribe of Judah. And Melchizedek was declared a high priest by God. Jesus was declared a high priest by God. And so it's according to the same order. And so that does show a tie between these two unique people of Melchizedek and Jesus Christ. Does Abram accept any of the gifts from Sodom, the king of Sodom? He wants none of it. He wants none of it. And what's his reason for denying it? That's right. He doesn't want riches of men. He doesn't want the riches, probably specifically of the king of Sodom, of all people. He knows of his wickedness. He knows of the wickedness of Sodom. I don't want any part of that. And so he wants his riches to come from God, and he doesn't want any man to glory over him and say, I gave Abram his riches. That's why he's doing so well. He doesn't want that to occur. So there at the very end, that is really what is happening there at the end of chapter 14. He does say in verse 24, I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshal, and Mamre, let them take their share. So he does say, let these men take their share, which is something that shows, again, a man of great faith and his willingness to not take it for himself. If you will look with me here in chapter 15, we'll begin studying verse 15. Let's read the first seven verses. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abram. I'm a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me, since I am childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram said, since you have given no offering to me, one born in my house is my heir. Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body. He shall be your heir. And he took him outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. Then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans, to give you this land to possess it. So here, as we're studying this part at the beginning of chapter 15, the word of the Lord comes to Abram in a vision. Now, has the Lord already spoken to Abram repeatedly? He's doing it again. He's doing it again. Is he saying some of the same things to Abram? Yes, he's doing it again. He's reaffirming, and he's going to do this over and over and over. He is wanting Abram to trust him completely, and he is willing to repeat it to him over and over and over. And it shows that God wants him to be faithful. He wants him to remember what his purpose is and what his promises are and how great they are. What specific blessings are listed here that are a little bit of a repeat here? A great nation. All right, he's already been promised a great nation. He's reminded of that great promise. What else? What was that? The land. The land that he would attain. The land of Canaan will be given to him. What else is promised again? Yeah, the descendants and how he would multiply. Right. In this case, he's already talked about you're going to have descendants as the sand of the seashore. Right. And now he's talking about he takes him outside. I think this is a beautiful scene to think about. The Lord taking Abram outside. And I wonder how he did that, if he just said, Abram, go outside, or if there was something that happened there where he got him to go outside. But he says, Abram, look up at the stars. Count them. And Abram's probably just like, I can't. And that's your descendants. That's how many descendants you're going to have. And Abram does say something that does show here at the beginning, in verse 15, a little bit of like where he's trying to tie things together here. He knows that his descendants are supposed to be as the sand of the sea, the sand of the seashore, as the stars. But he's wondering, who's the descendant going to be? Right now, my descendant is, who's this individual? Eleazar of Damascus. And so Abram's kind of like, how is this going to work, God, as far as my descendants? Because right now my heir is Eleazar of Damascus. In verse 3 it says, since you have given me no offspring, or since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. So that's who it fell to, is actually this man named Eleazar, because Abram had no sons. So what does God reveal to him specifically right here that has not been specifically revealed? It's going to be your own son from your own flesh. Now, God has not said that specifically yet in the promises, that it's going to come straight from your own flesh, and gave this much detail. But here he is saying it is going to be a descendant from your own flesh. That's where these descendants are going to come from, not some other man and Eleazar from Damascus. You can make a sermon out of verse 1. Do not fear, Abram, I am a shield to you. Has God protected Abram? Isn't it amazing that God says, I'm a shield to you, right after what just happened? He just went to war. I'm a shield to you, Abram. And don't you think Abram's like, yeah, you were. I had 318 men. And we just overtook these kings. You are a shield to me. You just helped me get my nephew back. That's an amazing statement to talk about a shield, an aspect of warfare in representation of the Lord. In verse 6, what is the significance of verse 6? That is a really interesting statement here. It reads, then he believed in the Lord, and it reckoned it to him as righteousness. What's so significant about that? That's right. God's saying these things to him. He talks about it's going to be an heir from your own flesh. And Abram's saying, okay. Oh, yeah, he's old. That's right. He believed the Lord. That's what's interesting. You will see Abram's faith just skyrocket. And then out of nowhere. And we're going to see it today even. And it's just hills and valleys. And is that uncommon to man? Is that uncommon to us? No. There'll be certain times when you're just so edified. And we come to worship and we hear a wonderful sermon and we're just like, I'm just ready to go and, spread the gospel to others. And I've got some people I want to, Monday morning this week, I'm going to make some changes. I'm going to do some things. Monday morning comes, Tuesday comes, and nothing happened. And we decline. And we go through these hills and valleys. And so it is encouraging to us to know that Abram is a man of great faith, but even a man of great faith has hills and valleys. Even a man of great faith is consistently needing to work on steadfastness. And is he needing to be reminded constantly that God is there and of our promises? I don't understand why a person would not want to come to worship or Bible class. I don't understand it. Because I know as much as I struggle and as much as we struggle as people, don't I need to be hearing this constantly? You could read to me the same chapter over and over and over again, and is it really going to go into application immediately? Probably not. Will I waver over time and forget it if I don't hear it again? Yes. And so that's why, sometimes does Doug use a sermon from years ago and pull it back out and teach it again? Should it still be effective? It should. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with, he preached that sermon 4 years ago. Well, that was 4 years ago, and I probably need to hear that again. Now, obviously, do we want to hear the same sermon every Sunday? Probably. No, I'm not saying that. But we need reminders. And it might be the same statements and the same passages and the same applications, but we need it. And that's what God is doing for Abram. Trust me. Here are the promises again. Here's some more detail. Just have faith in me. And it says here that it was counted to him as righteousness. Let's look at verses 8 through 11. Verse 8, he said, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? So he said to him, bring me a 3-year-old heifer, a three-year-old female goat and a three-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Then he brought all these to him and cut them in two and laid them, each half, opposite the other. But he did not cut the birds. The birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. I will keep reading. Verse 12. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and there they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. I did a weird grouping there. I'm going to pause there because I want to go into a different thought there. Let's go back real quick and talk about this section right here where it talks about, in verse 9, Abram, or verse 7, Abram is asking God about, verse 8, "O Lord, how may I know that I will possess it?" He wants to have trust in God, and so he's asking, how will I know this, God? What does God tell him to do? Prepare a sacrifice to him. Right. He says, prepare a sacrifice for me. And so that's what he does. He takes these specific things. It's a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old female goat, three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he takes those things. And it talks about the birds of prey came upon the carcasses. Abram drove them away. But we have him doing what God has instructed him to do. And he is showing right here again, he's kind of questioning God about how is this all going to work? And God is saying, trust me. Trust me. Do this, and I want you to trust me by giving this offering. Something that comes up right here that I think is very interesting is this section in verses 13 on through about 16. In verse 13 it states, God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you will go to your fathers in peace, and you will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." And so in this statement right here, this section of passages beginning of verse 13, what is God revealing about what will happen in the future? A lot of things. Specifically dealing with who's going to take his descendants captive. It's pointing toward Egypt. For how many years? 400. Now you think about how many years before this actually occurs is this being revealed from God to Abram? A bunch. And so 400 years is how long that they will be in captivity. And God is saying that specifically to him. Revealing this amazing thing about for 400 years your descendants are going to be oppressed. But he also says to him, although they will be enslaved, they will be oppressed. In verse 14, he says, I'm going to do what to that nation, though? They are going to be judged. Now, think about that. Was Egypt judged? Most definitely. I was talking to Pax the other night about how often in Scripture, great men of the Bible go to Egypt. Abram went to Egypt. You think about the sons of Israel go down to Egypt. Joseph went down to Egypt. Think about Jesus goes down to Egypt. All right, at some point, they go to Egypt in their lifetime. Why was Egypt such a hub? Why was Egypt so, like, what was going on in Egypt? Egypt was a prosperous place. Egypt was doing pretty well. And so when there's a famine, where do people run to? Egypt. So you think about right here, it is talking about Egypt, although it was such a strong, strong place, a strong economy, had everything going for it. If you remember the plagues, what happens to that country? It is brought to its knees. The Lord punishes that nation utterly. It is brought from the highest of points to the lowest by the Lord. And it is revealed right here that that's going to happen. In verse 14, I will judge the nation after whom they serve. Afterward, they will come out with many possessions. Did the Israelites come out of Egypt with many possessions? They plundered them, right? After the death of the firstborn, they were like, get out of here and take all my stuff with you, practically. They gave them all their goods and they left with an abundance.
That's right.
That's right. And they did. They took all of those goods.
And you know, the other thing is, Abraham can relate to this because he went to Egypt with Sarah, and the king was like, hey, here's all my stuff.
He got goods from that. That's right.
You know, he's understanding it's going to happen again to his family many years down the road.
That's a great comparison. Good. Excellent. Verse 15, as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. So it's revealing to Abram how he will go to his fathers in peace. He will be buried at a good old age, how the end of his life will come. And then let's look at verses 17 through 21. It states right here, it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark. And behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch, which passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your land I have given this land, or to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. The Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. So again, the Lord is confirming his promises, but specifically it says, on the day, that day, the Lord made a what with Abram in verse 18, a covenant. The word covenant is used here. Now, we will learn more about this covenant as we go on, because the covenant eventually is going to involve circumcision, right? But this covenant is mentioned, and it states that to your descendants I have given this land. We've heard that promise several times, but more specifics are given. From the river Egypt as far as the great river Euphrates. That is the land area you're going to receive for your descendants. And then it even goes through specifics of the groups of people that are in that land, of the Kenite, Kenizzite, Canaanite, and so on and so forth. I wanted to show you this slide. This is an excellent slide that Evan had in his slideshow, and I would hate for you all not to see it. So you see over here on your right this map. And it shows specifically the land area that was given, this land of Canaan, that would go to Abram's descendants. And you have also right here the actual affirmation of where this promise is fulfilled in Scripture. It comes from 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 21. And it reads, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, and 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen, and 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. For he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tifsha to Gaza, over all the kings of the west of the Euphrates. And he had peace on all sides around him. Is that fulfillment of God's promises? Can't get more specific, can you? Isn't that amazing? So you read here in Genesis chapter 15, the Lord is saying, I'm going to give your descendants all this section of land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. You go here to 1 Kings chapter 4. Solomon ruled over from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and brought to the border of Egypt. Fulfillment. Specific fulfillment made. That's a pretty amazing thing. To have that full picture. Now, what's interesting, did Abram have the full picture of this? He had to walk by faith. It goes back to Hebrews chapter 11. He had to walk by faith. What a blessing it is that we can zoom out and we can see the full picture and see promises made to Abram, the faith he had to have. Go over to 1 Kings chapter 4, it happened. So what does that mean when God gives me promises? I've got to have faith, and it's going to happen. I don't even need to question it. Because God has proven himself every time. Rose?
My study Bible that I use at home when I'm doing my reading had a really good comment, which sometimes I take it with a grain of salt. Particularly good. It's talking about faith. It says, it entails trust in and confident reliance on God based on the truthfulness of his words. And it will lead to obey. So, you know, we set aside, we walk by faith, not by sight. So, Abraham was walking by faith, not by sight.
Right. And the end of that statement is amazing because it talks about your faith is supposed to lead to obedience. what is faith without obedience? It's supposed to drive us to obedience. And in Abram's case, it did. It was counted to him as righteousness. He had faith and obeyed. Anyone have any comments or any questions about chapter 15 before we go into chapter 16?
You hit on something. Mm-hmm. Tonight about Abraham's humility, and it kind of stuck with me a little bit. You know, when you go back to the end of 14, and he stands there with Melchizedek and the king of Sodom, and he says, no, I don't want any of your riches. You can have it all back. You know, he and his 318 guys had just had overtaken these other kings.
No thanks. Yep.
No thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
That's right. And it shows his motives were completely different.
Yeah.
For the average man, the motive would be, yes, like I want to attain more, you know, possessions and more goods and the honor of men. Right. Man of great faith and humility. That's right. Excellent comment, Jonathan.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
What's going on there?
Mm-hmm.
But he's also giving them time, which I think is a good point to make. He's giving the Amorites time to get it turned around.
Mm-hmm. That's
now,
right.
Melchizedek was a priest of God Most High. You know, in the midst of a bunch of really corrupt people.
That's right. Can be done. That's right. It can be done. But you're right. It shows that God is a God of mercy and grace, and He wants to give opportunity for people to make things right.
The
judgment will come. That's right. That's exactly right. That's right. All right. Let's look at chapter 16 here, and let's look at just these first two verses in chapter 16. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "Now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. A very important text right here where things kind of shift a different direction. For Abram and for his family. Right here, when you're reading this, one of the first things that I think is a point is you have the introduction of a woman named Hagar. We did mention Hagar, I believe it was on Wednesday night, talking about how more than likely Hagar was given to Abram at what point? Right, when he was in Egypt, it was one of the things that was given to Abram by Pharaoh himself. Right, he received all kinds of female servants. And it's implied that he did not have to give those back. Although Pharaoh was afflicted with plagues and such, it seems like he left Egypt with great great blessings and great possessions when he left Egypt, including Hagar. So Hagar is given to Sarai. That's who is her mistress. And so that's who is she is a maid for. And in Sarai right here in verse 2 says, "Now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children." That's true. She was barren. She had not had any children. And it states, "Please go into my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. Does this show a lack of faith on the part of Sarai? What do you think? Both. Both. Both of them were well informed that there were going to be descendants that would come from Abram. Do you think that they should have understood that it was going to come from Abram and Sarai? Yes. This is where Sarai, and you hear sermons about this quite often, but Sarai is really taking it upon herself and saying, you know, I know what God's plan is. How can I make God's plan kind of happen here? Like, what can I do to kind of get things going? And so she takes it upon herself. And it shows on her part and on Abram's part a lack of faith. Now, who comes up with this idea? Sarai does. Right. But Abram, it says right at the end of verse 2, Abram listened to her voice. Abram said, okay, and he went along with it so that he would marry Hagar to produce offspring. This is where things get a lot more complicated. I've read some commentaries about this, and this is where some people say, well, this is where Abram's life gets a lot more complicated because of the possessions that he got back in Egypt, because of the Pharaoh situation, because of what happened there. And so it's just like a repercussion of that. I don't know if I would tie all that together. I just do know that it shows a lack of faith on the part of Sarai and Abram. It honestly does. When you look at verses 3 through 6, it states in verse 3, "After Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband, Abram, as his wife. He went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. And Sarai said to Abram, May the wrong done me be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight." So Sarai treated her harshly. She fled from her presence. When you read this, do you feel sorry for Hagar? I do. I think that's a natural human emotion. As you read this, you think about Hagar. She's a maid. Well, if you're a maid, what are you supposed to do? Obey your master. And so she's told, you know, you need to take Abram as your husband by Sarai. Okay, she does. She conceives and she's going to have a child. She hasn't had it yet, but she's going to have a child. How does that make Sarai feel? She is bitter. She is bitter. And so you have this whole thing right here where she is saying, and also it says, "I was despised in her sight," saying that Hagar was despising Sarai in her sight. But who does Sarai blame for all of this? Abram, this is your fault. The women are laughing. I'm not saying anything. But the woman is blaming the man and saying, it's your fault. You did this, right? And there at the end, it states, the last statement says, "May the Lord," this is the last statement that Sarai makes right here, "May the Lord judge between you and me." Now, Abram had every right to say, "We're not doing that, Sarai. Like, I don't think that's what God's plans are. Like, we're going to just wait, and things are going to work out the way they're supposed to. We just need to be patient and have faith." But Abram did go along with it. I mean, he did, and he's wrong. It did show a lack of faith. But you see just the bitterness of Sarai. And you can understand why she would have that bitterness in some ways. But was it her own doing? Yes, it was. Does anyone have any statements about that right there? It does remind you a great deal of Adam and Eve. A great deal of Adam and Eve. It's so similar in how that works. Yes. Cindy? Uh-huh. That's right. It states in verse 5. Well, let's just read all of what Sarai says in verse 5. Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done me be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight." So it does seem, you're exactly right, that Hagar is acting differently towards Sarai. She is. You're exactly right about that. She is acting differently. Yeah. And I think that there's bitterness on the part of Sarai, too, though. I do think that. I think there's just, yeah, there's conflict. That's right. That's right. I really think that this shows that man was never meant to have more than one wife. I mean, really. I mean, when I was growing up, men, I would have teenage friends who would read passages in the Old Testament and say, "Wow, like, wouldn't that be great to have, you know, look at, you know, Solomon or David, and they had all these, you know, wives." And No. And you can see, like, God did not intend for that to be that way. God did not intend that. I mean, the bitterness and the jealousy and the, it's toxic and it's not good and just damaging. Yeah, Rose? Right. Right.
Hagar is like, if one is determined, she's the second. Mm-hmm. She has no power. She's a servant in the house. So her child is not necessarily a free child.
That's right. Right.
So, you know, now she's kind of elevated herself.
Sure.
Over Sarah.
That's right.
And I think Sarah has a right not to be happy about it.
That's right.
But then again,
she came up with the scheme. That's the problem. So, yeah.
The fruits of her own.
That's right. And it is sad when you read right there at the end of verse 6, "So Sarai treated her harshly, and she fled from her presence." So Hagar leaves. She flees. Verse 7, "Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. He said, 'Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going?' She said, 'I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai.' Then the angel of the Lord said to her, 'Return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority.' Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, 'I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count.' The angel of the Lord said to her further, 'Behold, you are with child, and you will bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live to the east of all his brothers.'" So who appears to Sarai, or excuse me, Hagar? An angel. And promises are given. Promises are given. Are some of the promises given to Hagar and to her descendant, Ishmael, the same promises that are given to Abram? Yes. I think that's really interesting that the same promises, some of those same promises are given, like in verse 10, "I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count." That's a promise that was made to Abram. Now that promise is being made to Hagar and to her descendants. I'm actually going to leave because time's up. I'm going to leave the rest of chapter 16 for Evan on Wednesday because there's a lot of great things that we can talk about in these promises, especially in verses 11 and 12. But if you would, please read chapter 17 and 18. I think that we need to get up into chapter 18 through Wednesday night. All right, thank you all very much. I appreciate it.